Hey there, Super Sober Heroes. It's your host, Sober Steve, the podcast guy. And before we jump into today's episode, I want to take a brief moment to ask for your help to shape the future of gay A. Over the years, this podcast has grown and evolved as I've grown in my sobriety. And recently, I've been investing wild amounts of time, money, and energy to find ways to level up this podcast so it can get heard by the people who need to hear it. I want to take a brief moment to check in with all of you, though, to see what you love about the current show and what could be better as I'm growing and moving forward. In the show notes is a 3 to 5 minute survey for you to complete. I kindly ask that you pause this episode and take the time to complete it if you haven't already. You are kind enough to give me 20 to 40 minutes of your time each week when you listen to these episodes, and I want to make sure it's time well spent. So please let your voice be heard. Thanks, SoberPod, and enjoy the show. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Gay A, a podcast about sobriety for the LGBT plus community and our allies. I'm your host, Steve Bennett Martin. I am an alcoholic, and I am grateful for the unconditional love I get from my dog, Remy. As of this recording, I am 342 days sober, and today we're welcoming a guest to share their experience, wisdom, and hope with you. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Good to have you here. Why don't you introduce yourself to the listener?
All right. My name is Chris. My pronouns are they, them, theirs. I am an addict. And as of this recording, I have, on the 28th, I had 81 months. So just a little over 6 years, 9 months.
Congratulations. Wow. That's huge.
Thank you. Yeah, it is unfathomable on most days. I just, yeah, but also feels very right at the same time, you know?
Yeah. I hear that. Well, why don't we then just dive in deep with what your journey with alcohol and addiction was like?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Where to even begin? So I grew up, first and foremost, I primarily identify as a crystal meth addict. Mm-hmm. That being said, that's my drug of choice. That being said, you put it in front of me, I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. But like if Crystal's in that mix, I'm going to grab her first and then go for the other things, right? And so, you know, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest in a predominantly white neighborhood. We were the only Black family in my neighborhood. And from the very beginning, I was othered. And I was othered in a way that I think a lot of queer folks can experience, that like, y'all knew it before I knew it. And you made sure to tell me that. And so I just like, that kind of shakes you a little bit. You know, you're like, wait, I'm different from everyone else. I'm not, I don't just fit in, you know, I don't immediately belong here. And like, apart from the visual things, it was, you know, I was very, very, very effeminate. And so growing up, I was called faggot and nigger on a almost daily basis. And it gave me the opportunity to get some skills, right? And the skills that I really gained out of that were people pleasing and perfectionism. And so those are my first sort of like addictions, where I would manipulate you by being perfect and being exactly what you wanted so that you wouldn't be able to tease me. Right. And that worked for a very long time. And it sort of gave me this false sense of belonging. You know, I would like adapt myself to be whoever you wanted me to be. And therefore I fit in. Right. I didn't really ever belong. I just fit in. And as I got older, I started to realize how soul sucking that was. And so I looked for connection in other ways. And I'm of the age where the internet sort of came along, you know, I'm an older millennial, and the internet sort of like, we all got those CD-ROM drives of AOL, like 1,000 free hours of internet. And they came weekly, which is always like strange to me. Like, how much money were they spending on postage if they were sending these things like weekly to every house in America? Anyway, so I hopped on the internet. And I sort of found a tribe, you know, sort of really my first connection with other queer people was on the internet. And I just would spend hours, you know, I just would disappear onto the internet. And it sort of allowed me an opportunity to explore who I was and sort of find my voice in terms of like my humor and my like my repartee and like all that stuff. Like I was able to find it there in ways that I wasn't able to do with my peers and my classmates, because they just, I don't know, I just feel like queer folks are funnier, you know, like we just, you know what I mean? Like I just feel like there's a sense of humor and a wit that just comes with our experience that like my straight counterparts couldn't keep up with. And so like a lot of, I feel like a lot of my jokes and things were like just going above their heads. I should look into that. But yeah, I really just got to be who I was and sort of try on different things about my personality that sort of worked in that digital space. And so I immediately was spending until 4 or 5 in the morning on the internet, and my mom would get these phone bills and be like, what are you doing? You know, and I would be lying through my teeth, but she knew, you know, she was an attorney. She wasn't dumb. She could like put the things together. And so that was sort of my first foray in unmanageability, you know. Fast forward, that sort of progressed to finding there was a queer newspaper in Portland where I grew up. And in the back of it, there were these phone line numbers where like, connect with guys now. And I started connecting there. You know, I started lying about my age and connecting with men who were not age appropriate. And those were sort of my first sexual experiences. And that really is how I started using Crystal. You know, I was 15 years old and I had met someone on one of these phone lines, and we'd had a relationship for about 2 years. And I really felt taken care of by this person, you know, in a lot of ways. They sort of like, they taught me how to shave. They're like all these things that I was sort of missing in my single parent household, like they gave that to me. And then there was the sex on top of it. And so I really sort of like idolized this person. I don't know if that's the right word, but I sort of really looked up to this person and really was thankful for what they were bringing to my life that was sort of missing in my household. And one day he just like brought up these things, this paraphernalia, and was like, I don't want you ever to do this. This has sort of been destroying my life for 20 years, but I'm going to do this before we have sex. Right. And I just sort of like spent the next month trying to figure out what it was that he was doing, why he thought it was okay to do it in front of me, but then told me it was destroying his life. And, you know, I quickly found it because I am resourceful. I quickly found it. And I remember the first time getting high and just experiencing this level of tranquility. My body released all of the tension that I've been holding, which I didn't really realize it was there until it was. And I remember thinking that this is it. I finally have peace. And you couple that with the sex aspect of it and the way that like I was physically having responses to it. And I was like, this is really it. Like I have found my thing. And for the next, you know, 4 years while I was in high school, 3 years, really, I was in high school, I just sort of sought out crystal meth, you know. And at the time, my friends were drinking and smoking pot. Like that was sort of the thing to do in Portland, is like you drank, you know, Mike's Hard Lemonade and Smirnoff Ices and you smoked weed. And I was like, yeah, that's cute and all. And I would like hang out with my friends and do that. And then I would call that person and be like, let's get fucked up, really. You know, let's really enjoy it. And I sort of was really started living this double life where I was a really great student. I was training professionally to be a dancer. I was doing all of that. But then I had this flip side of the coin where I was like out 3, 4, or 5 nights a week, engaging with people I had no business engaging with. And I was okay with it, because for a very brief moment and every night, there was this moment of relaxation that came with this moment of euphoria. And that was worth it for me. You know, my senior year, things got a little bit crazy in terms of the unmanageability. I really, really started to become dependent on the drug and really couldn't stop. And it was starting to affect my schoolwork. It was starting to affect my dancing. And I got the opportunity to move to New York to train for dance. And I told myself that like, I was going to move here and I was going to start over. You know, I was going to leave that behind and really step into who I was meant to be, which was like this queer person living in New York and dancing professionally. And so I moved to New York. I left everything behind and life was good. I was training at this prestigious dance school and things were going really well. I was seemed to be well liked there by my teachers. And 2 weeks into it, I ran out of money. And I didn't know how to ask for help. And I had done some sex work in high school. There, I had experienced some homelessness at some point, and I had used sex work as a way to sort of pay for my things and keep up appearances at school so that folks wouldn't know that this is what was going on. And so I run out of money, and I didn't feel comfortable asking my mom for money. And I started to freak out. I started to panic. I started to think that maybe I was a fraud and maybe this wasn't for me and maybe I'd made a mistake. And, you know, I got on the internet and I did that thing that I always did, you know, and I got high. And that was sort of my cycle for the next 10 plus years. You know, things would be really great. I'd make these really great advancements in my life, in my career, my relationships, and a feeling would happen, or I would get a no at an audition, or I had a director who was really nasty with me, and I would run to drugs and alcohol without fail. Before I did anything else, like, my brain was like, this thing will take it away, if nothing else, for 15 minutes, right? And that will just sort of like erase all of the thoughts around this thing. The problem will disappear. And whatever the consequences are, you're really good at fixing it after the fact. So it doesn't matter. Just go do the thing. And that was just my life, you know, fixing and destroying, fixing and destroying, fixing and destroying, and really just running from all of my problems and using drugs and alcohol as a way to sort of to mitigate those feelings. And, you know, like many people, you know, I know I'm not unique in this, it just stops working after a while. And if I'm truly honest, it stopped working when I moved to New York. So it stopped working in 2004, and I didn't get sober until 2015. So in that time, I am really just understanding that there's a problem, not knowing how to stay stopped, and didn't know that there was a solution, right? And so I would do what I think a lot of people do in this situation. I bargain with myself. I substitute one for another. You know, so maybe I'll stop doing crystal, but I'm drinking alcoholically in ways that I've never drank before. I'm doing pot in ways that I've never done before. I'm seeking out, you know, barbiturates and the pills and all the other things to keep me away from my drug of choice. And everything just stopped working. You know, in those like 10 years, I disintegrated all of my relationships with my friends and family. I blew up my career in the sense that, like, I wasn't present there in the spaces, and I sort of like stopped training seriously. I stopped auditioning seriously for a few reasons. One, the no's were really hard and I took them really personally. But two, I didn't care anymore. You know, I was really so in the grips of my addiction. It was really about just like, how do I get high today? You know, and you know, I think about I think about like the moments in which I realized that like something had to change. First time it really happened was in 2012. I had gotten married, and my best friend and my husband were really just terrified for me. And I could see it every time I would come home from a run. I could just see it on their faces. Just like, they didn't know how to help me. And they knew that I was killing myself. And they just were waiting for me to make the decision on my own. Like, they had done enough research and they knew that like, this wasn't something that they were going to convince me was an issue, that I had to convince it of my own, or I had to come up to it on my own. And I remember every time I came home from a run, it would always be raining. It's just like the universe was just like set up this way. But I remember I was coming home one October morning and it was raining, and I was like, I got to do something different. And so it's a Saturday and I'm calling all of these like numbers on Google, like these rehabs, like, I got to go now. I got to go now. I got to go now. And they're like, you have to wait until Monday. And I was like, I'm not going to make it to Monday. Like, I'm just not going to make it. I have to go now. And I remember after like the fourth phone call of like being on hold and like waiting and like, you know, well, we've got something for a Monday. I just, you know, I called my best friend and I said, listen, I don't want you to make this a big deal, but I'm ready to go to rehab. I've been trying to call and they won't let me come until Monday. And I just need you to be on the phone with me for a little bit so I can like figure out what I'm going to do until Monday. And he said, hold that thought. I'm on the other line. Hold that thought. But where are you? Specifically, where are you? And I told him where I was at. And then he gets back on the other phone. We're talking, whatever. And then I noticed my husband walking up, and he like met me there. And that night, they had been setting up for me to go to rehab that day because they knew my cycle. It was like 3 days. They just like, they knew it. They knew I'd be coming home on this day, and they just like set it up. And I was ready. You know, I packed up my things and I went to rehab. And it was a pretty horrible experience in the sense that like it was like a psych ward. It was like 3 hours from my house. And we didn't have the program that we should have had because Hurricane Sandy happened and they were really close to the water. So a bunch of trees fell down and we lost power for 3 days. And we basically were just like camping out in this rehab for a week. And I never got the message. I just was able to sober up for a little bit. I met a couple of people and I went to outpatient directly following. And that was really powerful. I learned about my feelings. I learned how to identify my feelings and like how to label them and like what was coming up in my body. And I got on psych meds and I felt really good about life. And they had suggested going to 12-step meetings. And I said, absolutely not. Like, absolutely not. I'm not doing that. There's God there. It's a cult. No, this is working fine. I feel great, you know, and in that time I started auditioning again and I started booking some really big jobs and my relationship was getting better. I was like, I'm good doing just this. I'll be good. And so then I graduated and life was really good. And then life happened, you know, and I didn't have people and I did what I always do. You know, it wasn't meth, it was alcohol, it was pot, but it was like immediately blackout drinking, immediately pot all day, like immediately. And then 4 months later, I was using in ways I'd never used before. And then I disappeared for 2 years. It's almost like a blackout. Like I don't really remember what happened. All I know is like 2 years went by and I had another moment of grace where I just like looked at myself in the mirror and decided I wanted something different, decided that like I was worth more. And I knew a person who'd gone to rehab with the same insurance as me. My husband's best friend's husband also is an addict. And we both had been in our like individual struggles at the same time. And they both were able to commiserate around that. And he had gone to this really amazing rehab. And I called them and I said, I'm ready. You know, and I didn't tell anybody what was going. I came home from my using buddy's house and, you know, told my husband, hey, I need you to take me to the airport. I'm going to rehab. And the look on his face is one I'll never forget. You know, it just was, there was a sense of relief and joy and like, yeah, just like hope. And I went to the rehab and at first I didn't really hear much. You know, there was a lot going on. I didn't really hear much. And I was in, you know, it was in Dallas, Texas, and I was surrounded by a bunch of straight white men. And I really don't identify as any of those things. And there was a bunch of alcoholics and I didn't really understand that language either. Like, but a couple of days in, I just started to listen and hear things differently. You know, I heard consequences that sounded like mine. I heard feelings that sounded like mine. I heard this joy and hope, and these people had like changed their relationships with their families. And like, I wanted that, you know, and so I did what they told me to do. You know, we went to a meeting every day. I raised my hand. I was of service. You know, I came back to New York and I went to a meeting immediately. Like I dropped my luggage off. I already had the meeting set on my phone. And I went and, you know, I remember it was a very small meeting here in Brooklyn called Covenant. It's actually one of my home groups. And I raised my hand and I said, you know, I'm Chris. I just got out of rehab. I've got 34 days and I just want to stay sober, you know? And in that meeting, I saw another Black queer person who was also a dancer, who had a couple years of sobriety. And it's all that I needed to come back the next day. I just needed to see someone who had a story that was similar to mine, that looked like me, who could do this. And I came back the next day and I just sort of kept doing that. I was in every meeting for the first like 2 or 3 years. Like I was really lucky. I was in a situation where I could do that, just throw myself into the program and get connected to people. And I had 6 service commitments right off the bat. Like I was that girl because I had a desire not to be the person that I was when I came in, you know? And so I just did the things. Uncomfortable or not, I just did the things. I went to fellowship and I just got a fruit salad because it was $7 and it was just enough, you know, like to be there and to be eating something, but like not too expensive because I wasn't working. And it has changed my life. You know, it just really has given me things I never thought were possible for myself. And none of them are cash and prizes. All of it is how I feel and how I see the world. Like, full stop. That's it. So yeah, you know, I'm celebrating 7 years in July, and that's really just been it. That's sort of my story.
Wow. Well, what a story it is. Thank you so much for sharing. And what would you say some of the positive changes in your life have been since getting clean and staying sober?
Oh gosh. First and foremost, people. Mm-hmm. Having a sense of true belonging and community. I am... One of the things that was always missing from my life is connection with Black folks, Black queer folks specifically. I never grew up around Black people, and sobriety has offered me that. I have connection with most of the people in my life today are Black, and that is mind-blowing to me because I always struggled with that connection. I also have self-worth. I understand my value. I have agency. These are all things that just were sort of missing, you know, for the longest time being Black and queer. And at those intersections, I had been told that like, I don't matter. I don't have value. I should not have agency. I cannot ask for what I deserve. All of these things. And sobriety has told me that that's bullshit, right? That's bullshit. Take up space. You deserve to be here as much as the next person. And if someone is telling you that that's not true, then those are not your people. That's not a place that you need to be in, you know? And so I don't go to those spaces where people don't value who I am and all the things that I have to offer, because fuck them. Why? They don't get to experience all of this. You know what I mean? Like for free. No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I think that those are really the big ones for me, you know, just like how I see myself and how I see the world and my connections to other people, you know, that's a gift. Cause I think that's all we're looking for is just connection with other people and feeling like who we are matters.
Yeah. And speaking of connection, I mean, you talked a little bit about during your share, like how your sexuality played a role in your addictions. On the flip side, how would you say your sexuality has played a role in your recovery?
Oh, gosh. You know, I live in New York and I'm in CMA, New York, and that is primarily a queer fellowship. You know, none of our meetings are queer specific. You just go into one and good luck trying to find, you know, a straight person in New York and CMA. It's just like it doesn't happen often. And when they do show up, they don't feel welcome all the time, which is another topic for another conversation. But I think that I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that I'm getting sober, that I got sober in New York and this fellowship specifically, although it has been difficult. It has been a godsend. My outpatient was not queer friendly. Queer friendly outpatients here in New York City, I didn't know they existed when I was in rehab. There just wasn't enough research done. It was sort of like, I just need to find a place. This place is close to my apartment. And I went there. But, you know, it gives us sort of this shorthand language and experience. You know, I can talk about being the phone lines and being on the internet, and like there's a nodding that happens automatically, that there isn't like a questioning or like, what are you talking about? Like there's this, that happens. And so that has been super, super, super helpful. I will say, identify as trans non-binary. And so like that has been sort of a new thing sort of that is, I don't want to say struggling, but it's sort of been a new challenge to find those spaces where those folks are accepted in CMA. I think that a lot of times cis gay men love the idea of us, but when it comes to like sharing space with us. They don't know how. And so they're very standoffish. And so, yeah, I just think that it's there's more work to be done. I'll say that.
Yes. Well, what would you say are some practices you use in your daily life to help keep you sober and clean?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. And I think, you know, it's interesting that you're asking me the question now, because I have a couple of days under my belt. And so, you know, what are the things that I do now at 6 years, 9 months that are still the same as I did when I was counting days? The only people in my life are sober people, except other than the people that are like not addicts, the normies, so to speak. That was huge. I try to make a meeting every day. You know, if you look at my calendar on my phone or on my whatever, like there's a meeting listed for every single day. So no matter what is going on, I always know that there's some place that I can go to. And that's something that I sort of started in the beginning of my sobriety. And I say it with all my sponsees, just make a list for the week. Put a meeting on every single day of the calendar, because you never know what's going to come up and when. And just having that thing there has saved my ass so many times. Just knowing, okay, if I could just make it to 6:30, I can go to a place and I can talk about my shit, or I can just hear something, you know, that daily reprieve we sort of talk about, like that's it. And it's scheduled in my day every single day. Gratitude lists are huge for me. I started my gratitude practice in 2018 or 2019, and it has transformed my life. I sort of started it as a way to, I wanted to be able to find the silver lining, quote unquote, in every situation, even the situations that don't go my way. You know, there's a teachable moment in there, and that's the silver lining. So, yeah, so that's a thing that I do. Service. You know, I do a lot of service. I'm currently, God, this is so crazy. I'm currently the chair for a planning committee for a sober retreat that happens annually. We just had a retreat last weekend and it was amazing. We had 193 people present. 95 of them were first timers. It was the most inclusive retreat that we've ever had. I think that it's just work that myself and other people on the committee have really committed to. And that is, it's a large amount of service. It's a huge undertaking what we do, but it is so fulfilling and it gets me right in the middle of the hurt. You know, I don't, and that is, yeah, those are sort of the things that I do that are things that I did in the beginning that I'm still doing now. You know, also things like therapy have been super helpful. Psych meds were a thing in the beginning. I'm no longer on them now, but just like all the other things that can supplement the work that I'm doing with my sponsor and the steps and going to meetings. I need all the things. I needed all the things to get high. I need just as many things to stay sober. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's just how I look at it, you know, and it's been working, you know, and if something changes, I'll do something else.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that advice.
Yeah.
If you could give one piece of advice to someone who's newly sober or sober curious, what would it be?
Oh, I have two answers for that because they're different. For someone who's newly sober, I heard this in a podcast I was listening to the other day. The light at the end of the tunnel is quicker, or is closer than you think it is. Mm-hmm. And as I think about my beginnings and sobriety, the light at the end of the tunnel is so much closer than I thought it was going to be. And it's not the big bright light. It's the small little things that we accumulate along the way. It's relationships with people. It is a little bit more self-worth by doing esteemable acts. It is a morning practice. It is making my bed. Like all that stuff builds up into a bigger thing, right? And for someone who's sober curious, I guess the same answer there, but just try it.
It's a good one. And it's that simple, really, is just giving it a try.
You don't have anything to lose.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's just give it a whirl. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You know that it's here. You tried it. Like, there will still be people there that were there when you first come in. I mean, I see that all the time. People come, they try it. It's not for them. And a couple of years later, 2 weeks later, a month later, they're back. And we're still there. I remember a lot of these people. Yeah. We'll be here when you're ready. Don't worry about it.
And in recovery, we generally love our steps, traditions, and sayings. Do you have a favorite mantra or quote that you like to try and live by?
Good God, girl, get a grip. No, I don't. I love them all. I think that they are all important and relevant. And they change their meaning every day, and the impact on our lives. I guess I will say, I remember hearing the promises for the first time and hearing, we will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. And just being like, are you sure? Are you sure? And very quickly, you know, those nine step promises, they come true pretty quickly. Like, you don't necessarily have to work the ninth step for them to becoming true. And that was my experience. And that was really when I started to experience some of those things, when I was like, okay, this shit fucking works. Yeah. I'm going to keep at it, no matter how difficult, because I can see that the payoff for it is so much greater than the discomfort. You know, the discomfort will not last, but the things that I'm getting in return for walking through that discomfort, so much greater. So, like, just keep going.
For sure. Thank you for that. And if the listeners wanted to connect or get in touch with you, how can they find you?
They can find me on the internet. They can find me on Instagram at CPR Gives You Life. CPR Gives You Life, like the act of CPR, but those are also my initials. So yeah, it's a play on words there. I thought it was really clever with that one. And then also my sponsor and I have started a nonprofit for Black queer folks in recovery called the Black Yard Collective, also on Instagram. We're going to be up and running coming this summer. So yeah, Black Yard Collective for the organization, and then CPR Gives You Life for my personal.
Perfect. I'll be sure to link over to them both in the show notes. So listeners, you can just scroll on up and click on over at the @. Thank you so much for joining us, Chris. It was a pleasure getting to know you better.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And thank you, listeners, for tuning into another episode of Gay A. Please rate and review if you found this information helpful. And if you're interested in sharing your story, you can email me at gayapodcast@gmail.com or at me on Instagram at gayapodcast. And be sure to follow us wherever you're listening so you get new episodes when they come out every Monday and Thursday. Until next time, stay sober, friends.